Welcome to The Ether. Today is Tuesday, February 1st, 2022. This episode of The Ether is brought to you by LuArt. LuArt is the first gamified NFT platform built on the Terra network. LuArt provides a seamless minting and trading experience, all while earning you rewards just for being a user. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the community in Discord for the most up-to-date news and announcements regarding all the hot new NFT launches, platform upgrades, and new projects hitting the secondary marketplace. Are you ready to put your helmet on and join the movement? Find out more at luart.io. This episode of The Ether is also brought to you by Talus. Talus Protocol is the NFT platform for independent artists on Terra. Talus helps to provide artists with the tools and resources needed to transition from traditional art into the NFT world. With their V1 launch coming soon, Talus will be the place to see real-world art reflected on Terra. Be sure to join their Telegram and follow Talus on Twitter for updates on their roadmap, validator, and other Talus news. Find your next favorite artist on talus.art. Terra Spaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. Today on The Ether, something a little different. I know I thought I'd mix it up a little bit. This is a space hosted by Austin DeSisto, Space Journalism, Photography, and Physics. Something I think we're all interested in. Let's take a listen.
Welcome. We decided to do this space a little bit ago and then timed it well with CSG2. my name is Austin DeSisto. I write for Everyday Astronaut, and I've known Trevor for quite a bit of time. We work with him. We work with Declan from Flight Club quite a bit as well. And so we figured that it would be nice for him to kind of come in here and talk, maybe even answer some of your questions about how they do what they do. So Trevor, if you want to go ahead and maybe introduce yourself a little bit for anyone who might not know or just needs a refresher.
Sure. So my name is Trevor. I am a launch photographer and I work for Ars Technica and basically cover everything SpaceX, NASA, going on here in Florida as well as California and Starbase as well, Boca Chica. Depending who you who you ask, but basically anything rockets, I try and be there to capture it, and I seem to find myself a lot of the time using tools that we'll talk about today to be able to pull stuff like that off. I shoot for Ars Technica. You've probably seen Eric Berger's articles somewhere at some point, and I basically serve as the photographer to help bring some cool looks to the lead images that feature at the top of those stories. That's pretty much it. Probably pass it off to Declan here.
Cool. Thanks, Trevor. My name is Declan Murphy. I am the guy who made flightclub.io. that is my only title. I have no cool affiliations like Trevor, like with Ars Technica or anything like that. It's just me and Flight Club, nobody else. I'm all alone. Flight Club, to anybody who doesn't know, is a, well, probably if you're in the space, you probably know what it is, but just in case, Flight Club is a rocket launch simulation tool. Which has kind of evolved into a tool for photographers to use to plan out long exposure photographs and other kinds of photographs of rocket launches, which actually was Trevor's idea initially back in 2017, I want to say. It's actually kind of thanks to Trevor that we're all here to begin with, but we can get into that later. And yeah, that's enough about me, I guess.
What gave you the idea for Flight Club originally?
It wasn't an idea, really. It was so I did physics in college, and then I did a 1 year computers course. So to practice the code that I was learning, I just made a little, like, in the same time that I was doing the 1 year course, that was when SpaceX was trying to land, or, like, you know, soft water land their boosters. And I was like, oh, I wonder what it looked like when they're doing RTLS and going back to launch site. So I did a really shitty, I did a really low quality kind of simulation of a rocket launch and landing. So like the Earth was just like a 2D circle launch from the North Pole, the atmosphere and nothing like that. Just to see what the boost back trajectory shape would look like. And I posted it on the SpaceX subreddit, and people liked it, and they were like, oh, make the Earth 3D, make it launch from Florida, make the Earth spin, add an atmosphere, add in this, add in that. And I just kind of kept adding in little bits and pieces. And then I got a job as a Java developer, but I had learned C in that course. So I converted it all to Java just to practice. And then in the job, they were using databases. So I put a database in it to practice, and they were using APIs. So I built an API to practice. And I basically just used this software project as like a playground to practice all these things that I was learning in my first job. And if I broke things on there, it didn't matter. So that was the idea. So it was just one big playground for like the first 3 or 4 years of its existence, and nobody knew about it really, apart from 10 people.
And how did you sort of grow it from like the initial project, I guess, or playground into, you know, meeting us and photographers and kind of pooling that together?
Well, like I say, I think it was when you got in touch with me and you asked me if you could use it to plan out, I want to say it was CRS 14. Am I right with that? I think those were four.
CRS 15 was the first 15. One.
Yeah. Before CRS 15, you wanted to do that shot over the palm tree. And you got in touch with me and you were like, hey, can we use Flight Club to prep this? I think my first response was just like, no, like full stop. and then you kind of pushed me. You're like, yeah, if we do this and we do that and we do that. And I was like, oh yeah, maybe. And I remember just like hacking together some really, really crappy photographer's toolkit that I had to give you a huge walkthrough to use, because it was like, it just didn't make sense at all. It was like this last minute hack together.
Yeah.
But it worked. And then I think you were like, dude, I pay for this. If this was like a monthly thing and it looked nicer and it was easier to use, I'd pay for this. And I was like, oh, okay, that's an idea. So then I just started working on it, and obviously it's been a bit of a semi-success, and I think it's probably about around 70 or 80 photographers now using it, mostly on the Space Coast in Florida, a few in California, and then I don't think I have anybody in Texas yet, but hopefully that will change soon. So yeah.
Well, And one of my questions too is, I'm interested, how did your process of like refining that into making it, you know, kind of like you said, something usable, how did that go? Were there any like major challenges you had to overcome?
Not really, because I didn't know anything at the beginning. Like, I didn't know anything about front end design. I didn't know anything about user interfaces. So I had to learn everything from scratch. So there was no real point where, I mean, like, there was a million points where I got something and I was like, how the hell do I do this? But that was nothing new, because I was learning everything from scratch. So whenever those moments kind of came up, it wasn't anything new. My assumption was just like, this is probably easy to somebody who knows how to do it. I just need to figure out how to do it. So there was never anything really kind of disheartening or discouraging in terms of problems to solve, until now, that is, because now I have to try and solve Starship's aerodynamics, which is a kick in the groin. But no, in terms of the photographer stuff, no, I think it's pretty easy. Actually, no, sorry, that's a lie. There is one thing that people have been shouting at me for years, and I have no idea how to get started on, And that is a native mobile app for the photographer's toolkit. Mm. And every time someone brings it up, I'm like, yep, that's in the pipeline. Yeah, don't worry about it. And in my head, I'm like, that's never going to happen. But maybe. But yeah, for the moment, I have no idea how I would begin on that. So yeah.
Yeah, well, I think. Go for it.
You go ahead, Trevor.
I think I've got a little clip here that I wanted to tweet of what the first photographer's toolkit that I used for that shot. So I'm gonna be that.
Do you really?
Everyone, just go click on Trevor's profile, and you'll be able to see there. I think Twitter Spaces would be a little easier if you could maybe share screens or something, but this is how we'll do it for now.
Yeah, that's a great. That would be a good feature. So there's this little clip. I'm trimming it down here.
I'm simultaneously excited and dreading.
Yeah, basically, the photographer's toolkit started out as, rocket launches fly the trajectory, and depending on when you're north of it or south of it, it can look kind of different. I'm gonna tweet this out of your photographer's toolkit v1. And then while I'm talking, it'll upload, but it's uploading here now. But photographer's toolkit basically started out as an idea to plot out, in 3D plus with camera settings, as far as like, I'm going to be wide at 24 millimeters, or I'm going to be telephoto in at 70 millimeters, or there's the video. If you click on my Twitter profile,
that loading animation, I'm actually going to like that.
This is what the original photographer's toolkit looked like, but it basically allowed you to see, plug in a location, see what the trajectory would look like from that location, and, plan out a photo by plugging in, full frame camera or APS-C crop sensor camera. It was really rudimentary at first, but the follow up to that, the picture that I first did with Declan on that mission, I'll tweet out here.
Yeah, that was a pretty hot photo.
It was really
I can't believe it worked in the first go as well. I guess that's testament to you more than to me.
It's a testament that we didn't run into as many scrubs as as CSG had, I think, as well.
Which, by the way, we'll come back to, because holy crap. The shots you got yesterday were insane.
So yeah, this this is the first one that we did. And so if you look in the video that's at the top of the thread, you could see the palm tree there flat on the ground, which is what I used as sort of the subject. And, kind of like it was almost like thinking of it as a vertical wall or something like that. The closer to you get to the tree, the taller it will be in front of you. If you're standing right at the base of the tree, it's going to be over the top of your head. And if you stand, 25, 30 feet away, it's only, 10, 20, 30 degrees tall or so. So there was a point that I needed to basically move away from the tree, but not so far that it would be real small so that you wouldn't really have a subject in the picture. But not too close that it basically, the launch went behind it, if you will. Because the trajectory from that exact location within a couple of feet, and with even a quarter mile probably, would look roughly the same. So as long as you're standing the correct distance away from that tree, you'll get the trajectory basically to fly right over the top of it. And so this was kind of the first example of chasing all of that, putting it all together in terms of a picture and a plan.
So would you say that it really, you can get the trajectory from like the general location, but kind of like you were saying, once you get there, you're going to have to mess around with the objects around you and have to really figure out exactly where you need to be to within like a couple meters sort of deal.
Right. Within a couple meters. you know, it's you have to be kind of specific with it now that I've learned, but if you have it just depends on what kind of, I guess, what kind of needle you're trying to thread. If you're trying to fly the trajectory through like a gap between two trees, or like yesterday trying to get the landing burn, you know, positioned underneath the tree to the right side, you have to have sort of a land marker. Austin, if you want to take over for a second, I can get some of the other talking points that I want tweeted out. We can keep going.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, I think you touched upon yesterday, which I think is kind of where you're going to maybe hit a little later. But, you know, Declan, why don't you talk a little bit about, especially considering, you know, now that we've seen how the first, you know, version of the photographer's toolkit looked, and then compared to how the shot he got, like, how have you been able to refine the photographer's toolkit as, you know, over the past few years, you know, based off of the shots that, you know, photographers were starting to get, you know, like what have you seen here that's made you, how, you know, that has been almost feedback to make it better?
Yeah, that's a great point, actually, because before the photographer's toolkit arrives, I wasn't really focusing on accuracy that much. I was like, as long as it's going the general right direction at launch and it's more or less the right shape, then the people who were following FlyClub before that just cared about like things like, I don't know, like the acceleration or the velocity or that kind of stuff. It didn't need to be exact, it didn't need to be spot on, it just needs to be like a general, like generally correct. But then once the photography stuff started, it really kind of, it made FlyClub need to be more accurate overnight. So yeah, I had to start taking the photos that photographers took, the location they took them from, the camera they used, and then comparing that to what FlyClub would show. And then after a launch, after the fact, I'd go back and I would tweak the flight profile that I had made in FlyClub to make it match their photo, which obviously is no good for that launch because that launch has already happened. But let's say that was Starlink launch 3. Well, if I go back and tweak it, then that tweak will be good for Starlink launch 4 and 5 and 6 and 7, because they're all the same.
Absolutely.
And obviously now there's Southerly Starlink launches. So the first time they did a Southerly Starlink launch, I had to just guess. But then once we had photos of it, I could use those and go back and modify it. So for example, there 2 weeks ago or something was the very first Southerly Starlink night launch from Florida. And it was in front of a full moon, and people were trying to get this transit in front of the full moon. And I was like, well, I have no previous streaks of Southerly Starlink launches to go on to build my profile. So I'll just build something and hope for the best. And I missed, obviously, and all the photographers who tried to do it missed. Well, that's a lie. I mean, one guy was very far south. Like, if he had used FlyClub, he probably would have missed, but I think he just guessed and got very lucky, and he nailed the, well, I mean, maybe he didn't guess, maybe he knew, I don't know. But he nailed the transit anyway. But everyone who used FlyClub, they all missed it. It all went too low for them. But then after the fact, I got a bunch of photographers who do use FlyClub to send me the photos they took, and from like the exact location and their specs. And I got some from south of the pad, some from north of the pad. So I got kind of a few different vantage points. And then I went back and I tried to make the FlyClub ascent match theirs as perfectly as possible. So if that does happen again, hopefully it'll work the next time. I mean, fingers crossed. I'm sure like they're never exactly the same, you know, because of, I don't know, weather or whatever other small perturbations come into it, I don't know. But I mean, you can't plan for that stuff. So if I have it nailed on, if I have it nailed relative to the previous launch, that's the best it's going to be. Like, it's not going to be better than that. And if it misses for some other reason, well, then it doesn't, you know. Yeah. This is just me covering my ass. When the next Starlink comes along and everyone misses and they get angry at me, I say, well, yeah.
I did say
yes. So it's really you having to, you know, having to take, you know, you kind of start off with as good as you can get, and you take, you know, the results based off, you know, the results from photographers based off what you gave them, and then kind of reverse that to get something even more accurate. So you can kind of triangulate it to be exactly what it needs to be. And so would you say that, like, through each launch on a, you know, generally same trajectory, you start to get just more accurate and more accurate to the point where you can predict something pretty well?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily even need a photographer to have used Flight Club for the first one. As long as they give me a photo with the location and the settings they used, I can use that and like begin from zero. I don't need to begin from a previous iteration. I can just build something from that. So I guess, for example, let's say Astra are going to launch from the Cape soon, and I know very little about their rocket because their specs aren't public. I'm sure some of the specs are public. Like I kind of reverse engineered the thrust of the engines from that failure they had where they lost one engine and I had a thrust away ratio of exactly one. They were like, oh, now we know that the five engines have 120% thrust to weight ratio. Anyway, I don't know everything about their rocket, about Rocket 3, as I would about Falcon 9. So I'm not going to be able to make a very good profile for that launch. But if people take photos of it and take streaks of it, and then they say, hey, here's the arc, here's what it looked like, here's where I was standing, then I can try and reverse engineer that arc. And then for the next launches, I can hopefully have something good. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of, like, it's definitely a big feedback loop. Like the photos that get taken come back to me, and they go into the flight profiles, and they definitely make it better over time. Yeah.
All right. So I've got some of the visuals that I was going to talk about with the picture yesterday loaded up. So if you go into the thread at the top, there was the first iteration of the photographer's toolkit, and then two tweets down. The third tweet in the thread, the first picture of which is basically what Flight Club spits out today, which is a lot cleaner, I will say. It looks good, Declan. and you could see the VAB, if you turn on the 3D terrain, with Flight Club, there's different levels. So if you're at, you know, a certain patronage or membership level, you get basically the trajectory. And the simulations at the next level, you get the photographer's toolkit, the trajectory, all the camera tools that lets you plug in the, you know, millimeter length, camera, setting specifics. And then at the level above that, you could turn on, you know, bits that use OpenStreetMap to basically, you know, show you in the 3D viewer what buildings you'd be looking at. So in the first picture at the bottom, you could see the big square VAB kind of as a landmarker almost for where in space the trajectory is going to fall on either side of it. And then if you look at the second picture, that's basically overlaid with where I was standing, what it should look like. And then if you go down to the tweet below that, you could see I sort of am going through, I go right over the top of the camera, and then I zoom all the way in. And then if I shift just a little bit to the right, you could see the VAB just peeking out behind the tree. So I'm basically trying to line that horizon, the VAB and the tree all up and at the same point. And, you know, just had to basically find where that spot was. And, you know, using the Flight Club, you know, millimeter selector, I basically went 20 by 30. Okay, 30 is a bit too thin. And I backed it out to, you know, 28. And that's the millimeter that I ended up with. And then the final tweet you could see is kind of the plan on the left overlaid with the tree. And then the picture that resulted with afterward. So you basically just, as long as you have a ground-based point of, you know, the VAB and where it exists, then, you know, that's sort of your
safe haven, I guess you will. It's like the saving grace. Like if without the VAB, you'd just be hoping that your compass is accurate enough that it's telling you your camera is pointing at whatever azimuth you need to be pointing at. So having basically like a ground-based point to base the whole picture off of was instrumental in getting it as specific as I did.
Yeah, total. I mean, and that's honestly something that I don't think anyone realized, because truthfully, you know, until I made it down there, I didn't realize, you know, how visible the VAB was from, you know, various places. But from what you're saying, I'm gathering that a lot of the, in terms of camera placement, angle and everything, a lot of that you're calculating within the photographer's toolkit. And then once you get out there, you just need to make sure that your whatever you actually physically do to your camera matches it as close as possible. Yeah.
Yeah, basically. So the steps are find a subject that might be photogenic. And this was just a tree alongside a hiking trail on the north side of the Merritt Island Wildlife Refuge. And basically, I wasn't even there for launches, for location scouting or anything. It was just kind of like going on a hike somewhere. And I don't know, you just kind of take it in that could potentially be something that's worth taking a picture for. And so I'll get my phone out. I'll take a quick picture at, you know, on the newer iPhones, it's got the widest angle is 13 millimeters. So I'll usually snap a couple, both vertical and horizontal from a couple different locations. And then mark down as pins on Google Maps, basically where I took those. So then in the future, if I wanted to use that spot, I basically have all the information without having to go and hike back out there and, you know, snap those pictures. So the first step is basically finding something that's worth taking a picture of. The next step would be finding a launch to line it up with, because nowadays there's crew launches that go up the East Coast to the Northeast. Now the Starlinks go to the Southeast, you know, polar launches go to the South. There are, you know, spy missions and stuff like that, or maybe, who knows, that go basically straight to the east, equatorial missions that basically go straight to the east. So there's a lot of variety in the shapes of trajectories that you can get, or, you know, shapes and photos that you can get based on where you stand. So a northeast trajectory could look the same theoretically as a equatorial trajectory if you're in different locations. And the same goes for, you know, a south trajectory could look the same from basically like straight west of the launch site as an equatorial one does in Cocoa Beach. You know, they're kind of, you just need to pivot around where, you know, where the trajectory is heading and where you're standing relative to where it's going. But so step two is just finding a launch that basically lines up with that composition or subject or tree or kind of greenery that creeps into the scene, almost like a vignette kind of thing. And then the third step is basically figuring out the exposure settings to make it happen. And I would say the picture from yesterday is probably one of the more challenging ones, just because at those times when the sun is rising or setting, the light is really dynamic. And especially 10 minutes after sunset, you know, you wait a couple of minutes and the exposure settings completely change. So I had to spend a couple of days basically going out at the same time relative to launch and sunset, but the days ahead, and try and nail down those settings. So the first day that I went out, I was like something like five stops off on my exposure, which basically, if you're not, you know, if you're not aware, five stops is basically like black versus a well-exposed photo. So it was super dark. It was probably recoverable if I needed it to be, you know, if that had been the launch, but it was for my purposes, it was kind of a miss. And then the next day revised it. I went a couple stops brighter and was still even then a little bit short. So I'm glad that I basically spent the time to figure out the exposure setting. So it's basically like location or subject, finding a launch trajectory to line it up with that subject or a time of the day that launch or trajectory goes at that makes it interesting. And then, you know, finally, basically putting the rubber to the road of making sure that the camera can sort of bring the idea from a, you know, a point of which it's just an idea into, you know, making the picture a reality. That's kind of a long and short of it, or a long and long of it.
Well, yeah. And I mean, so as many of us probably know, CSG2 scrubbed many times. Did you use all those opportunities that it scrubbed that you would have gotten the launch to do more practice, or did you just kind of pack it up and go at that point?
Yeah. So the scrub, basically just allowed further narrowing. So I planned to do, two full days kind of testing, one at sunrise and one at sunset, all previous to the day of launch. And so I was pretty much ready to go if it would have gone on the first attempts. The weather prevented us from it really prevented the idea at all from even being attempted because it was so cloudy. So I basically initially did all the testing for nothing and, you know, not to hope for a scrub, but was kind of like subtly hoping that the idea might be a possibility if it did scrub. And then it scrubbed the first day and it was like, all right, but you got to do it again to Saturday if we're going to be able to do this. And then it scrubbed to Saturday, and then the testing began basically again to sort of whittle those settings down towards what I wanted to do. So yeah, it definitely allowed more time for basically getting closer to perfect, so I didn't have to do so much brightening or darkening kind of thing.
Absolutely. Now I'll just throw another question here. If you were to now go do something like this or something as challenging as this on the West Coast, you know, how would you kind of adapt to that? And maybe even Declan can chime in here after you.
Yeah. I mean, the DART, I have a picture from the DART mission in November, that might be worth posting here. Declan, if you want to talk maybe about how the 3D terrain, while I get this posted, can be advantageous to California or other places where there actually is terrain and it's not Florida, like a flat cake.
Yeah, sure. The 3D terrain in Florida is pretty useless. Anybody on Space Coast who signs up to that is probably wasting their money. But in California, it's a huge difference. Actually, you know what? While Trevor's doing that, I'm gonna also tweet out just a screenshot of what it looks like in Florida versus what it looks like in California. California is awesome. The terrain there is really cool. And seeing it in Flight Club is also really cool. I can say that because I didn't make the terrain. I just put it there. Someone else made it. So I'm not blowing my own horn there or anything. But it looks really cool. It also looks really cool. So I live in Monterrey in the north of Mexico. And as you might guess from the name of the city, Monterrey, it's surrounded by mountains in all directions. And when you look at Monterrey in the photographer's toolkit, it looks awesome. And like the mountains that are outside my front door, like have this real distinctive shape. And that shape is preserved in Flight Club. It's really cool. But it is actually a huge deal because if you don't have the 3D terrain in Flight Club and you prep for a launch in California, your camera will be at 0 meters above sea level. But obviously ground level in real life is going to be, I don't know what it is, probably, actually, let me check. Whatever it is, it'll be like, I don't know, 100 meters, 200 meters above sea level. So that could completely mess up the composition of your shot. It could be a completely different thing. And also you might miss half of the launch behind the mountain if it's poorly placed in front of you. So yeah, in Florida, you haven't got these problems. The biggest mountain in Florida is probably the VAB. But yeah, in California, it makes a big difference. Hang on, let me screenshot this. That's a nice sunset.
Yeah. So while you're doing that, I just added the DART plan and got to the thread that I've got going. And you can see, if you zoom into the first picture where it says stage one, you can see kind of in the flight club, where the launch actually begins is behind that mountain. And then in flight club, it basically shows the mountain range. So I knew sort of not the third peak from the left, it was the fourth peak from the left, basically exactly where the launch was going to come up. And so if I don't have, say, the VAB in the field of view, I do have 3D terrain that I can rely on to basically fix the trajectory to a point in space. And so sort of like I was shifting up and around the tree just to basically see that the VAB was there. If I line up, you know, that set of mountain peaks in this specific area of the picture, and I'm at the settings that I say that I am in flight club, you know, 16 and 16, and it's in the bottom right corner of my frame, then the trajectory is basically going to fly the same path through the picture. And so it's really just about lining up the real world with you know, with the prediction, and kind of equating the simulation onto the arguably the simulation.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it doesn't show every single rock and every single tree and whatever, like you got to use your own intuition a little bit, but
right,
I think it's probably good down to like a 5 or 10 meter resolution. Like, yeah, it gets the important features, but it might miss, like, I think in that Dart one, you got it next to, I don't know, did you tweet it already? I didn't see it. You took it next to kind of a Jodiati rock.
Yeah.
Which obviously wasn't shown in Flight Club, but the main feature next to you was there.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I can see your tweet there.
It was called the Lizard's Mouth Rock, in Santa Barbara County. I don't think it actually has like a city with it, because it's just kind of like a nature, you know, area, park or whatever. But it's sort of east of the Solvang area, if you've ever been there. It's probably like an hour and a half or so east of Lompoc, and basically straight north of Santa Barbara. But anyway, yeah, Flight Club, you know, only shows the 3D terrain. It didn't show the Jodiati rock, but that's where the sort of intuition, I guess, comes in.
I'm tweeting out my screenshots now of the different terrain, different places. So go ahead.
Okay, I'll take over while you're doing that. No, I think, you know, that definitely covers the question of you know, the difference, because most of the shots we see now from Trevor and other photographers down the Space Coast are trees or other, you know, various flat terrain. And so I think, you know, it sounds like it must be, you know, pretty interesting to be able to go onto the West Coast and try to incorporate that a little more. You know, the photographer's toolkit definitely handles that quite well. Now, yeah,
I've got one more picture that I can post, maybe to give a little bit more food for, you know, talking about questions and stuff like that.
Go ahead.
But this final one is again an example of basically using that the combination of 3D terrain and the ground-based objects of basically lining up a picture. And let me see here, get this posted out. So this mission was the SOUCOM 1A. It was the first SOUCOM mission. This was the one from Vandenberg, California, before the second. It was SOUCOM 1B that launched from Florida. So that was that the first polar launch?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I think so.
Yeah.
Did they not launch a SOUCOM before that? Was there not a 1A?
There was a 1A. This was from Vandenberg.
I can't remember, to be honest.
Yeah.
I have to go look. I don't have that off the top of my head.
And so this is SOUCOM 1A. Basically, just posted that to the end of that thread. If you refresh or basically just refresh Twitter, it should show up at the end. But that this is another example of basically using I could see the pad off in the distance, and so I was able to line that up in the photographer's toolkit, as well as the 3D terrain. So I had those hillsides inside of Flight Club when planning to be able to basically, you know, not cut off the top of the streak where the booster was going to ascend to at its apogee, and, you know, be able to keep it in the frame at all points. And then it was, you know, location, finding the trajectory, and then the exposure setting. So I basically did the same exact thing where I went out 47 minutes or something after sunset and tested the exposure. And the raw picture actually doesn't look too different from, you know, from the from what you see, because of the preparation that goes into it. But that's kind of three or four examples of you know, the three-step process, I would say.
I'm just trying to remember, was the SATCOM-1A a direct insertion into like a 500 kilometer orbit or something?
I think so.
Was it one of the, one of the ones that went up like mental straight at the beginning, and then the stage two pitched down?
Yeah, the trajectory was basically just a line. It basically just ascended, and what felt like it was leaving my frame, even though the picture took out perfect, it felt like it was leaving the frame like, I don't know, 45 seconds or a minute into flight, because it was just so steep from anything that I've ever been used to in the past. And then, yeah, the stage two basically to stay at altitude basically pitches up to not fall back into the atmosphere.
I think it's difficult to tell in that photo because you can't see like a regular Falcon 9 kind of trajectory to compare it to, but like a regular Falcon 9 trajectory would be like half that height.
Right, and it arcs. I think the easiest way to tell is like the first picture with the Dragon, you know, it arcs over and it's traveling horizontally for quite a long time. But in the last picture, you know, CRS-15, that being, and this compared to SATCOM-1A, like it's basically vertical, 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 vertical. And right at the end, it sort of tips over a little bit more horizontal, but it's nowhere near horizontal. And so then the second stage basically has to fight its way towards staying aloft.
Yeah, those profiles are mental.
Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, like stage one has to give it so much upwards velocity that even if stage two just pointed sideways and went from the get-go, it would still go high and it wouldn't go orbital. Like it had to point down towards the end of the stage two burn to kill all the upwards momentum that stage one had given it. Yeah, it's crazy. Like it has to get to 500 kilometers altitude before Seagull and then go sideways. Yeah, it was just, yeah, absolutely mental.
It looks like there's It looks like there's kind of a plane adjustment as well. There's kind of a curviness to the second stage burn.
I think I remember at the time looking at it, and you mentioned that, and there wasn't, so like in Flight Club I hadn't done any sort of plane adjustment. I had just done that crazy stage two pitching down to try and circularize. And then from your point of view in the photographer's toolkit, you could see that kind of wavy part towards the end of the stage two burn.
Uh-huh.
So I think it was just some artifact of the way they had to do that pitch down thing. And like, even looking at the photo right now, I don't know how to explain it, but I remember in that moment, I didn't do any weird plane changes in Flight Club, but you could see it in the photographer's toolkit. No. Yeah, it is just some weird artifact of that crazy.
Maybe it's something where the fuel was being, or where the exhaust was being directed, you know, up or down or whichever way it was pointing, because it was then backlit. You know, maybe it was higher or lower than what it, you know, what a normal line would have looked like if it wasn't backlit, kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Crazy weird phenomena, though.
Yeah, really weird.
But yeah, we've talked for a while. I definitely want to allow people to chime in and say hello themselves. So
yeah. For sure. So if people, if you have any questions, go ahead and just request to speak, and then we'll just do it in order. You know, if you just have a comment, want to applaud these guys for their work, you know, I'm sure they'll appreciate it too. So we'll start with, it looks like, let's see. Start with Joshua Fisher, as soon as you connect. Go ahead and unmute and speak when you're ready.
Okay. Hey, guys. I'm Josh. I'm a photographer out at NASA Armstrong out here in SoCal.
Howdy.
Hey, Josh. Yeah, I've always loved seeing your photography. Like, it's something I don't really get to see all too often because, you know, Vandy, it's busy, but it's where I'm at is kind of not a great ideal location to get any pretty shots. But it's always interesting to see, you know, the effort, because I've seen some of the pictures that you, Trevor, and John Krause have kind of posted, like, oh, here's the setup. And it's like, I think John the other day posted something of him wading through a swamp to get a photo set up. And it's like, have you ever had a photo that you kind of were like, ooh, I really want to do this, but then when you try getting it set up, has just, you know, you were like, nah, it's not worth it?
Yeah, I think that that all happens like basically between steps one and two. It's kind of like you find a spot that you really like, and you sort of try and strong arm your way to make the trajectory sort of line up with it. But then either the time of day or the moon's in the way, or, you know, the moon is kind of front lighting it in a way that, you know, there's sort of something that comes in and it like doesn't really sweeten the deal as much. So yeah, that definitely happens where, you know, you sort of abandon one idea, sometimes even on site of the idea. And you basically are like, no, I'm going to go with something else this time. So yeah, that definitely happened.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah, that's something I've always been interested in, because I'm more aerospace and not rocketry, and I've always wanted to get into it. And it's just, it looks like it's hard work to get all that set up.
Yeah. Does that happen to you out at Armstrong?
It's most of our stuff's kind of real time, but there will be times where I'm like, oh, okay, I think I'm going to be like here for, you know, a plane taking off, or, you know, we have to deal with a lot more of ITAR restrictions, and just because at least we're government, and
right,
the, you know, it's, we can't publish because all of our stuff goes out into the public or public domain. Right. So it's like, it's a little hard to try and figure that out, because sometimes the, you know, a hangar will be open or some plane will be out, and it's like, yeah, it's a public, people know about it, but we can't take pictures of it. So, you know, we'll have something, and sometimes it'll be, you get back and you notice, and afterwards, oh, there was a B2 Spirit out in front of Plant 42. And so all those photos that we took of Sophia taking off are now, you know, just like, we don't even get told sometimes why they're like, why they're basically, you know, oh yeah, you can't publish that. We're just told, yeah, you can't publish that. Yeah, we have to run it by like Air Force security and all that.
You're just like, sayonara, that was nice.
Oh yeah, it's like, oh, that was such a nice photo, and bye bye.
Cool. Well, thanks for the question.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, thanks for answering.
I just want to say, I don't restrict any of my employees from posting any photos that they may take of my office. Just want to point that out there. I'm a very liberal, forward thinking, kind of free company over here. Just saying that.
Yeah, I've tried asking my boss about that, but I don't think I have clearance to actually go up and knock on his door, because it's, you know, in DC.
Yeah, I mean, I was joking. I have no employees. Sorry.
Yeah, Declan basically makes us keep all of our, we have a whole body of work that we're not able to publish because of how bad the flight club trajectories were.
Trevor, shut up.
Sorry, was that a
violent? That's the worst feeling, is when, you know, you work real hard to try and figure out a photo, and then you get back, like, you finally get to look at it, and it's like, ooh, that was bad.
I just tried to load up Flight Club, and it doesn't seem to be working anymore. Oops.
Well, I think it's absolutely, you know, that was actually great. So thanks, Joshua, for joining us. I think it's great.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Both you and Trevor, and then all the other, you know, photographers out there, all deal with varying levels of difficulty, whether it be, you know, Trevor, John, for example, wading out into a swamp, or kayaking, or, you know, having literal, you know, restrictions as to a specific reason why you can't, even if it's just a few pixels. I think that's incredible. It looks like we have another question coming up here, so we'll add Steve Rice. As soon as you connect, go ahead. Whenever you're ready, Steve.
Sorry, I had a little glitch there. yeah, I'm Steve Rice. I'm just relocated to the...
What's up, Steve?
Hey, Trevor, how's it going? I had the pleasure of meeting Trevor a few times in Wallops for some launches down there. And I'm just one of those people in the background running around taking...
Steve, I'll interrupt if you don't mind. Steve is the original guy to combine Flight Club with the moon and sort of luck into it. So we're all jealous of Steve and his moon transit photo with Antares.
Yeah, you're all riding on my coattails.
Right.
I just really wanted to extend my eternal gratitude to Declan and Trevor. Apparently, I didn't know about the behind the scenes origins, but that really, like, that was probably the greatest experience of my adult life. And
that picture.
yeah, and I shouldn't mention it, but I was very shameful that I didn't actually use the photographer's toolkit for that.
You're not supposed to say that part.
But that was a complete stroke of luck. That was a huge fluke. But I wish I could make it down for the flight tomorrow. The launch in Vandenberg, but maybe someday. So
yeah, you'll have to come down for a booster when it's coming back to land.
I know. I mean, I know you can see him pretty far north. Maybe I don't have to go that far, but I mean, really, thanks again. This just, it's absolutely insane watching what you guys do with that. So keep it up.
Thank you, Steve. It's probably a good thing you didn't use Flight Club for that, because if you did, you would have missed. like for moon transit photos, always miss it.
I actually got a phone call from a guy who tracked me down and was asking me how in the hell or heck did I even get that. So, because he had used Flight Club and was kind of pissed off.
That's the best.
That's awesome. Well, Steve, it was great to briefly meet you up here, and thank you very much for joining. I was unaware that you were the original moon transit photo person, and I've seen the recent ones, but definitely just checking that out real quick. That's an incredible shot. And honestly, after seeing what Flight Club has done, I'm surprised. it's kind of crazy what's the word I'm looking for? How accessible it is now with what Flight Club offers.
Yeah, I mean, if more people can start using it and start getting transit shots, that's a win-win, right? but yeah.
Or not use it in that case.
If they can use it, miss, realize the Flight Club is useless, and then get their transit shot by themselves later, yeah.
All that means is if I try it again and I don't get it, then I'll have no excuse whatsoever.
I'm going to go out there and be like, move your camera to the side next time. Ah, you did it. All right. Good talk to you, Steve.
Yeah, thanks. You too.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Any more questions?
I currently don't see anyone else requested. So if anybody has anything, feel free to add on. I'll throw a question here for Declan that I've had for quite a while. I know, especially when writing articles and stuff, there's often times where we have questions about inclination or certain timing of events or stuff like that. Declan, do you want to highlight a little bit about kind of the simulation aspect of Flight Club? Because that definitely helps me, someone who isn't taking photos, you know, down the Space Coast or in Vandenberg or in other locations. If you want to detail a little bit about that, some, that would be great.
About how I figure out where it's going, is that what you mean? Or
yes, exactly, yes.
Okay. So for any launch, okay, how do I start this? For any launch, I'd need to know the inclination and the orbit that it's going to. So like the, you know, apogee, perigee, and inclination. For like, if you know the inclination and you know the launch pad, you can figure out what the launch azimuth will be. But then additionally, you have those hazard zones to airmen and to marine vessels that get released before launches. And if I draw out those zones on Flight Club, which I do,
it kind of draws out the launch azimuth for you. So even if I have no idea what inclination it's going to, but I have the hazard zones, I can figure out the launch azimuth that it takes. In terms of if I don't know exactly when Miko will be, for example, or if I do know when it'll be, but I don't know how high it'll be or how far downrange it'll be, but I know where the drone ship is in terms of Falcon 9 launches, then I can use that to say, so what I do now after having done a load of Falcon 9 launches and just kind of figured out from experience what SpaceX's strategy is for landing boosters at sea. They generally start an entry burn at around 60 kilometers altitude and finish it at around 35-ish. And then they glide, they kind of induce like a small angle of attack, maybe like 5 degrees or something in the booster to glide, which scrubs off a lot of velocity and it keeps the altitude from falling too fast so that you can get down to kind of 300 meters per second or so before the landing burn begins. But doing that increases your downrange distance. And like as you're gliding, it increases how far downrange you go. So what I always try and do is at Miko, have a ballistic trajectory that lands short of the drone ship. And then it means that when I code in the entry burn and the glide and all kind of stuff, that will kind of extend that out to the drone ship. So if I use that, I can figure out what the booster state is going to be like at Miko. And then stage two is usually pretty easy to do, because stage two's responsibility is more just to kind of get into orbit and circularize, whereas stage one is really the stage that kind of defines how high that orbit is going to be by how steep or how shallow that launch ascent is. And then it's the same for like for Atlas V, for Delta IV Heavy, for any rocket, they all kind of have their own strategies that they just repeat over and over again for each launch. I'd actually say Falcon 9 is probably, well, maybe it's because Falcon 9 launches more, but I feel like Falcon 9 has more distinct strategies. Like Atlas V, for example, copies the exact same thing every time. The only difference is how many SRBs there are, and then depending on how many SRBs there are, it pitches over sooner or later. That's about it.
Okay.
But then Falcon 9 obviously has no SRBs. It's the same two stages each time. So if it wants to go to a geostationary, or if it wants to go to, you know, sun synchronous, it has different strategies. But yeah, I would use the hazard zones. I use the drone ship. Actually, that's about it, I think. Hazard zones, drone ship, target orbit. Knowing the payload mass isn't that important. It only gets important towards the end of the stage two burn, because during the stage one burn, the payload mass is a rounding error, like it's nothing at all. But towards the end of the stage two burn, when your stage two is just 4 tons and maybe you have 10 or 20 tons of propellant left, a 5-ton payload is a lot more different to a 10-ton payload. So, you know, that's kind of important, but not really. I think that's about it, really. The rest of it is just looking at previous launches, looking at past ones that are going to similar orbits and seeing what they look like, and then just trying to replicate that. So it goes without saying then that if you're signing up to Flight Club for photographing a launch, and it's the kind of a launch that has never been done before, so if it's a new rocket, or if it's a new flight profile, or if it's something like that, the uncertainty in my flow, in my trajectory posted, is much higher than if it's just another Starlink, or just another sun synchronous, or just another geostationary, or whatever. Yeah, that was a very long version. Hopefully that answered your question.
No, awesome. Totally. And I think that's a fantastic insight that we might not, you know, have necessarily been able to get otherwise. So definitely thanks for telling that. I'll give a
few seconds. Is there other pending questions?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'll give a few seconds if anybody else wants to request. And then if not, I think we'll be able to wrap up here.
I got one for Declan in the interim. Yeah. We'll wait if we have a couple more. How much of the original code, you were talking a little bit before about how Flight Club kind of started as like a playground, just to kind of mess around with the code. How much of the original code of calculating trajectories or plots or stuff like that lives on today?
Up until the 2 weeks ago, a lot of it. But that all got absolutely blitzed with the release of version 3. Like a lot of what I had was real naive. Like it was super naive. Just kind of guidance and stuff. Like I didn't do engineering or anything like that, or aerospace engineering or anything like that in college. So I didn't know anything about controllers or guidance and navigation or anything like that. So I had real naive stuff, which I have gotten better at over the years, but I never went back and fixed the code as I learned more stuff. So yeah, starting from March last year, I started this new, a new version of my physics engine, which was a complete rewrite. So there's nothing left from the original, unfortunately.
RIP.
I did want to have version 2 and version 3 simultaneously alive, but I was just causing problems. And I was like, you know what? Fuck it, I don't care. And I just like, I hit delete on version 2 and, you know, git add all, git push.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, it's gone. It is gone. So nothing at all. And in the front end as well, there's very little that remains. The front end gets kind of refreshed every 6 months or so as I learn some new technology.
Can we bring back the GameCube style look screen?
I completely forgot about that. I love that. Yeah, I'll dig through the repository screen, try and find it, and I'll bring it back.
That'd be so awesome.
I like my current one. My current one is Starman going around a unnamed planet, which I quite like. But
scrolling down the front page of Flight Club, this I think the favorite little glyph is the Starlink satellites going off and passing through the little night sky
and fading out. Yeah, I like that one.
It looks like we got someone who wants to ask a question. If we want to let them in real quick.
Yeah.
These spaces can be slow sometimes. All right, whenever you're ready, go ahead.
Oh, hey, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, loud and clear.
We hear you.
I gotta tell you, Trail and Joan, you guys are really great. Stuff. I really like your stuff, like all the pictures and stuff. You know, it's like a guide. I'm still learning. I got a question for Trevor. So surely. I'm trying to use a Flight Club, you know, to catch the, you know, the whole arc and also what you call the reflection of it on the water. Is there any kind of trick or tip you can give me, like, you know, to get it right?
So reflection shots are especially tough because you need obviously super calm water. But the main trick is if Flight Club is showing sort of have you use the photographer's toolkit?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you are in sort of that view, the camera pitch metric is the one you're going to want to pay attention to.
Okay.
You're going to want to zero that out, basically. And then once you're on site or wherever you're watching the launch, if your camera has sort of like a level or, you know, a focus point that you can make like the exact center of the field of view, sometimes you can press the D-pad or whatever, and it'll sort of go from wherever it is to the exact center point. You'll basically want to put that on the horizon. So you only want to be looking basically straight out of the tripod. You don't want to be pitched up. You don't want to be pitched down at all.
I gotta be straight.
Right. As long as Flight Club is showing the top half of you know, your field of view, the bottom half will be empty because that's where the reflection will be. But as long as it's showing the top half in the sky, you know, not leaving the frame at whatever focal length you want to do, you know, 24 or 16 or 18 or whatever it is,
as long as you're pointing, you know, straight, even and level with the horizon, and assuming the water or a boat, an airboat, or a pile of mud doesn't float into your frame, not speaking from experience at all, then your reflection will look perfect.
Cool. All right, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the question. Good luck.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Tweet the picture if you get it, or at least your attempt, and maybe we can help you fix for round two.
Yeah, I tried yesterday. I messed up. It was so much so much light. I couldn't figure it out. So
yeah. Well, if you ever have questions, feel free to reach out.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. If nobody else has any more questions, we can wrap it up. Trevor, Declan, if you have any closing comments you'd like to share.
I would say thanks for setting this school. That's all I want to say.
Yeah, this is fun. I like answering questions and you know, sort of going back through the old pictures is it's kind of reminiscent of you know, old pictures and old plans, and especially like with seeing, you know, sort of going through them through time, you kind of see how the ideas and sort of the plans become more technical and complicated and morphed into, you know, better pictures in the end, but they require a lot more thought. So it seems to transition from luck in the past to, you know, now really ensuring that you get it or the way you planned it kind of thing. So
exactly. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like almost every picture has some sort of story to go along with it, whether it be the location or maybe a certain feeling of the launch or whatever. So I surely can relate to that feeling of being able to go back and think about not just the image, but how it was captured and maybe even some of the struggles.
Yeah, exactly. Like with the picture yesterday, you know, it required a bit of a hoof out to the viewing site, and, you know, having to do it several days in a row, that definitely that will definitely be a memory that I won't forget for a while.
Awesome. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you guys for making the time to join here. And thank you to everyone else who was able to spend about an hour with us tonight. If you have any feedback, feel free to reach out. And if you want to see something like this again, then we can definitely think about that in the future.
Thanks for the idea, Austin. I will say this was your brainchild. So thank you very much. This was cool.
Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah, thank you. I surely had fun. So thanks for joining.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for checking out another episode of The Ether. That was the Space Journalism, Photography, and Physics Space, hosted by Austin DeSisto, recorded on Tuesday, February 1st, 2022. This episode of The Ether is brought to you by WeFund. WeFund is a community crowdfunding cross-chain incubator on Terra and is the first launchpad that implements a milestone funding release system to protect investors. All money raised for projects is deposited in Anchor Protocol and is refundable, and all decisions are based on community voting power. WeFund is community-focused and designed to be a user-friendly experience for both project creators and investors. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the Telegram for more information. Links are in the show notes, and check them out online at WeFund.app. This episode of The Ether is also brought to you by Orbital Command, a community validator on Terra dedicated to educating, expanding, and promoting the Lunatic community. Take advantage of their Terra Luna Intel report on Telegram, which brings you the hottest news and updates on all things Terra each and every day. Find it using the link in the show notes. You can also support their community efforts by considering them next time you're delegating or redelegating your Luna. Find out more at orbitalcommand.io. Terra Spaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening. They say rapping is the gateway, bringing home great pay. Checking that replay, sing along and we say nobody gives a fuck around my way. I make about $3 for every 1,000 plays, so add it up and do the math on that. Financially speaking, why the fuck would anybody want to rap? But in this reality, the money comes from doing shows. But then where's the money go when you can't do the shows? I guess you could rap on Cameo. I've been asking all my friends if I can rap on the patio. 6 feet, motherfucker. Fuck
to step the fuck back. Doing a little magic, pulling rabbits out the rucksack. Not everybody's always in it for the money. Looking like another crooked Sunday and I'm working Monday. So you know I ain't stressing, left debating great methods. Amazed to play Inception, the base stay blessed.
See, even with these huge sums of overall royalties, huge sums of money that go to the record label per playback can seem insultingly small. Many rights holders are making around three quarters of a cent to listen to one of their tracks, leaving only some portion of that for the actual artist. Can't even say they're making pennies per play. Until they can figure out how to turn a profit, their future will always be in question. But for now, investors see enough potential to continue to fund pennies per play.
Another day, another lesson. Living in the eighth dimension might be worth a little mention. Living in the Great Depression, got a real regal feel. Reeling in another sucker fish out to make a deal, just to make a motherfucker wish. Aw, shit, now you only got two left. You know what I wish? We didn't have any loose ends. You know what I miss? Listening to excuses. Now we're on the fence like we forgot how to choose. That's what happens when people don't know what's true. In the dark, eating bullshit up like a mushroom. In the lunchroom, just trying to laugh it off. Meanwhile, foaming at the mouth like a rabid dog. Like a fake mating call at the zoo. It's looking like the view is getting disappointing too. I'm working on the new shit, trying to produce it. It's what I'm willing to go through when I'm making my music.
Spaces.